Hello, Buck friends. Today is our long-awaited episode on dystopian literature. You know, if all you know about dystopian is The Hunger Games, which we are going to talk about, you may not realize that the dystopian genre actually asks some very deep, very Christian questions. So, if you are ready for an exploration of this popular, fun, and sometimes disturbing genre, along with several great recommendations of books you can read next, then pull up a chair and join us.
Hi, I'm Trisha.
I'm Amanda.
I'm Elizabeth.
And welcome to Book Fair Podcast.
Do you love books, or do you want to?
Are you tired of picking up the latest new release and finding it's filled with junk you don't want in your life?
Has motherhood somehow made your brain a dusty shamble?
Friend, you are in the right place. We are three friends and mamas on a mission to create a fun, bookish community, pursuing a deeper life through the reading life.
We are your trusted source for books of all flavors.
Always grounded in truth, goodness, and beauty.
So, if you're ready for scrumptious literary fare among friends,
grab your cup of coffee, your load of laundry, or the steering wheel,
and pull up a seat at the table. Okay, it's review time. So, I want to read this little review from General B27. First of all, I love how internet names happen. I have so many questions.
But it sounds like R2-D2. It has, yeah, Star Wars vibes, yeah, to me.
General B27 says, this podcast is a great listen. The episode length is perfect for a work commute. Excited to hear what's to come. Thank you, General B27.
Thank you
for that. And if you enjoy this podcast, then you too could go on and write a review in your Apple Podcast app and put your name in a drawing for some Book Fair swag. The purpose of this is to grow our podcast and to let others join our family and come talk about our favorite subjects, which is books and life.
Love it.
Okay, today we have the much anticipated, from the very beginning, we've hoped and wondered and dreamt of the day that we would talk about dystopian books.
Oh boy. Yay.
I mean, here we go. People who are not readers have read dystopian books. And that is what I really love about this category, is that we can all come together and talk about a sad future world where there's a terrible government. Yeah.
What is it? Like, even though there's part of me that does understand, there is another part of me that doesn't understand. Why do we love this so much?
I think it's a common fear. I mean, you know, people on the other side of the aisle from us are not voting differently because they hate our country. They're voting differently because they have fears and concerns. And even though they want to walk it out in a different way, they're usually rooted in the same fears and concerns that we have. And so, dystopian books for me are the thing that we can all talk about and all use as a cautionary tale and maybe try to have this harder conversation that we're out here trying to have on C-SPAN and whatnot in a different context and find a place where we come together on it. And we go, okay, well, nobody wants that. So what are the steps? So I would love for us to look at dystopian books as the great uniter in the terrible things.
Okay.
I mean, it is true that they can be both master classics. They can be super quick commercial fiction. They can be really good commercial fiction that is going to be an amazing movie also. They can be anything. So I have some quick, like, what's a classic? What's a classic dystopian would be? Atlas Shrugged. I mean, there, I would say new classics, but Fahrenheit 451, 1984, things that you might have read in school and had to have big talks about. But then, you know, everybody's kids are wanting to read like Hunger Games and the Divergent series. And The Handmaid's Tale was tons of people's high school assignment. Now it's a hit show. Well, that's a dystopian book. Was it a book or a series? It was a book, right?
Series, I think.
It was a series. But I haven't read it, so I couldn't.
I don't know, though.
It was a book, but then she recently wrote another installment. So now there's
okay,
two.
Okay. So It does not matter who you are. You can find something within this category that you'd grab onto. So if we wanted to give an Oxford English Dictionary definition, we're recording back to back, y'all, today. And so I thought, well, I have to get one from, I have an imagined state or society where there is a great suffering or injustice. And I thought you will often find it social or governmental injustice, or sometimes both. And they're so interwoven that it's hard to know the difference. There's often a theme of wars have landed us here. So even though this is really awful, we have to cling to it because we don't want to go back to war. So when we were talking a second ago about dystopians being rooted in fear, they're also held there in that place by fear. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because we all have things that we fear and worry and are concerned, and it's hard to step into something new. I think this is why it lands with us all. Like, the devil you know is less scary than the one you don't. So, I know Amanda is going to come with a great other definition, and I really want to hear yours too, because I always love the way you define terms.
I want to give my bibliography for the day, because I pulled strongly from the Literary Life podcast, episode 92 about Fahrenheit 451, and also an article written by Andrew Clavin called An Alternative to Dystopia. So I'm just putting it out there. I am directly quoting them. I am synthesizing what they said. Go check out those resources too.
A while back, we did an episode called Trisha Has an Idea. And in preparing for this dystopian episode, I was thinking about it. And Trisha, would you like to give us a quick throwback to your warm and cool feelings of books?
Yeah, back in episode 26, kind of crazily named Trisha Has an Idea,
for now,
I threw out another way of talking about books and sort of the emotional tone of them as a way of deciding what we're drawn to and just being aware of what we like and don't like. And to me, cool tone, and this can be applied to other kinds of art, like movies or art, something that has a cool tone is written or experienced from a little bit more of an emotional distance. And something that has a warm tone is like more all up in the emotions. So you're very much feeling what the characters feel. You're like right in there. It's all, you know, the big, bold feelings. So oftentimes something like a spy novel will be more of a cool tone. Or a mystery novel, because the author actually has to give you some distance or there would be no mystery. If they revealed everything everyone mm-hmm. was thinking and feeling, you would have the solution. So they have to do it from a bit of a distance. Much, not all, of children's literature is very warm. They're trying to bring you, invite you into the space of the characters, what they're thinking, what they're feeling. They want you to connect. Oftentimes something that's told in first person is warm. Not always.
Because you get the inner dialogue.
Right. You're getting the inner dialogue. You're thinking with them. You're feeling with them. Harry Potter is very warm.
It's my suggestion that all, if not almost all, dystopian books are cool in tone. Would you agree?
Yes, I would say almost all. It's such a huge category.
Yeah, that would be a bold statement to make in entirety.
But I agree. I think it is almost all, yeah.
And I do think a lot of the reason it goes back to that fear that they're rooted in, because, you know, I remember in Fahrenheit 451, he barely didn't trust his own brain. And so it's like, I can't even think these thoughts because someone's going to know. So therefore, you don't get that inner dialogue, the emotional, you get these withdrawn, rigid movements.
Yeah.
That are looking over the shoulder into the whole time.
Yep.
I'd like to hear more about what you mean, Elizabeth, about rooted in fear. You think the characters are in general, or just the main characters?
I would just say each dystopian book that I've read, I have felt like, you can tell me if I'm off, I have felt like there was a fear that it was tone that it was all nested in, that the story just birthed out of. Like, you know, we are afraid of the government. We are afraid of each other. We are afraid of our children's gifts. We are afraid of ideas and words and what they could do. We are afraid to go back to the time of war. We are, I just read The Giver last week. We're afraid of differentness and the unexpectedness of that. So now we seek to control. So there's a fear and a reaction to control. And even the people being controlled don't want to be in the control, but they're fearful to go into something new. So I always feel like dystopian is just rooted in fear, which is something that we all get.
Yeah. And from the author's perspective, essentially, it's like they're writing this story because they're afraid that could actually happen. So
yes. It's a cautionary tale that they need to make sure everyone has thought through so that maybe this doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And I love that you use the term cautionary tale, because I think these novels, in terms of the intention of the authors, are at best a warning for people.
Yeah.
And for us to like sci-fi, like fantasy, like going to another time or place in great literature, it makes you turn around and look back at your real world and see it in a different way.
Yeah, I remember in our sci-fi episode, you talked about sci-fi always is going to be asking the question, should men have done that? And I think dystopian might ask the question, what would happen if we ran with this standpoint? Like this one standpoint that where it seems like a small detail right now, like this and that should be separated, or you should not be allowed to say this because it's mean. You know, everybody here can agree that's mean. So what if we ran with the fact that you should not be able to say that? Or there's things that I disagree with. And what if I really didn't want anyone to read it ever? I mean, that's Fahrenheit 451 talks about the idea of ideas. And are we okay with that? And them being printed. And what if we regulated ideas? Well, where would that stop? Because it's so much farther than you realize always. And you usually
that's
go, oh,
so true.
I got to check myself. I don't want to go there. Or, you know, the Hunger Games, if we go way to junior high level and say the Hunger Games series. I remember Trenton's little friend group got into that at like fourth or fifth grade. And I was like, oh, whoa, 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 whoa. I hope to read this one day, but it's not going to be today. But honestly, it was the first time that I really talked with him about appropriate levels, because I was like, this is a great book. This is not a bad book. When you read it, I'm going to want to talk to you about it, because man, this is so much here, but it's not for a fourth grader. But the idea of government control, and what if I just say, you make the corn and you make the metal things and you make this and we remove choice, and oh, do we have a free society or do we have prison? You know?
That's great. Clavin talks about this too in his article. It's so good, you guys. And he, with each point he makes, he refers to three examples throughout: Brave New World, The Giver, and The Matrix, the movie. Which, so good. I mean, red-pilled.
Right. It's part of our vernacular now.
Right. So he says the question for dystopian work is, are we revolted by the elements in this book? And are we revolted by it in our world today? And he goes through and actually gives examples. For example, he says in Brave New World, like about Soma and the drugs, I just read that. Just read Brave New World for the first time. But he talks about being revolted by reading about living that way. But 1 in 6 Americans use mood-altering psychotropic drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a concern? And then The Giver, they throw babies out.
Yeah.
40 million babies are exterminated per year right now. And The Matrix, you're plugged in and we have the metaverse. Right now.
Mm-hmm.
And how easily people retreated into cyber life in 2020.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And another way of saying that is, I think of it as the author sees something in society and they ask the question, what would happen if we took this to an extreme?
Mm-hmm.
Or what would happen if this runs rampant or goes unchecked?
Mm-hmm.
And it allows us to reflect on that question.
Clavin also says that a characteristic of dystopian literature is inhuman humanity, which is along the lines of what you're saying. It makes me think of like the aging actresses that have used too much fillers and they don't look like the same person anymore. And they can't show their emotions on their faces anymore.
Yeah.
And it's sad.
Because the fear there would be age or being less than perfect or being real. You know, mm-hmm. I want to be the Velveteen Rabbit. You know, I'm looking worn these days, but but real.
Yeah. Yeah. And this characteristic in human humanity also reminds me of Lewis's Men Without Chests.
Yeah.
That it's not what only what we do physically to ourselves, to our appearance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when we pursue intellect or, you know, the head or pleasure, the gut, and not having ordered and proper emotions, like in Brave New World, that wasn't allowed. You're not whole, and you're less what you're made to be and less what you ought to be. And in none of these books do these societies, like, they're not a people who are pursuing virtue.
Yeah.
They're not voluntarily operating in service to others, open and warm to family and friends. You know, it's not that kind of a world. So I loved his point in that phrase, in human humanity.
Yeah, that's a great way to frame it.
Yeah.
I would love to hear some favorites of y'all's.
Y'all's.
Let's just be real.
Possessive.
After I've gone on my real rant, I should just say what I say, which is y'all's.
Go ahead, Amanda.
Well, I just finished Animal Farm and Brave New World for the first time. Fahrenheit 451 is one of my heart books. Mm-hmm. If dystopian can be a heart book.
Yeah.
Because the rebels are like memorizing Shakespeare and saying it to one another because they don't totally understand why, but they know it's very important.
Yeah.
And I can very much identify with that.
Yeah.
And in my journey in classical education, I don't always understand why, but I trust the whole of human knowledge for the last however many thousand years, you know. In 1984, I read that for the first time maybe last year, I think. And probably 451 in 1984, I like the most. Oh, and I should throw in Harry Potter 5. I don't know if that is totally dystopian, but Umbridge is right up there. She is her own little big brother.
Yeah.
In Hogwarts. Oh, she's just awful, but she is painted so well. But I think the angle on 451 I like the most because it's about preserving the ideas and the traditions.
Mm-hmm.
That angle really hit me. Brave New World was tough. That was a tough read. I had no idea some of what their society did, and even as young as children. And that was hard. I didn't want to be in that world. I didn't want to think about that. That was hard.
Yeah, but so powerful.
Trisha, you got some favorites?
So I decided to gather three more modern literary dystopians and ones that people may not have heard of, especially the first two I'm going to talk about.
Great.
The first one is called The End We Start From, and it is by Megan Hunter. And this one is short and poetic. Elizabeth, I think you would really like this book.
I feel like that's on my list, actually.
I think I mentioned it one other episode. I don't remember which episode.
Okay.
But it is, and I like these first two are actually in this category, where it's sort of a vague, distant future. The first one, there has been some kind of environmental catastrophe, but you don't know exactly what it is. Like, it's not pointing to any one thing, but it is written, it's in the UK. It starts in the area of London, and water is just rising. And there is this woman, and she's unnamed, but she is giving birth to her first child in the middle of this catastrophe. So, you know, you can imagine the counter feelings of like joy and beauty of having this child, but then the fear of bringing a child into the world amidst this kind of upheaval and unclear, unsure future. And it's kind of this poetic meditation on the infant child, the infant mother bond, and the innocence of childhood on a backdrop of fear and uncertainty.
Hmm.
So it's just really interesting and intriguing and lovely. And the writing is just beautiful. She's a poet. And so the writing is just really lovely. So it's definitely, I thought it was interesting that you brought up cool. It is definitely cool. It's poetic, but it has this kind of detached vibe to it. So definitely a grown-up, thoughtful dystopia. Mm-hmm. The end we start from. Another one in this category is called Census by Jesse Ball. And this is a story about a man. And this is in a dystopia. Again, it's vague. Like, it's not one of these, like, The Hunger Games where it tells you, like, this is the world and this is the government we're living in and these are the rules and this is what's been set up. Like, it's more of a, it just throws you into this probably near future world, like maybe 10, maybe 20 years in the future. But some kind of oppressive government thing has happened, and you're not exactly sure what. But this man gets a diagnosis, and he's a single father of an adult child with Down syndrome. And in the wake of this, he decides to become a census taker. And so it's a journey novel, you know, shout out to Odysseus and some of those original journey novels. It is a journey novel of this man and his adult special needs son going off to try to find answers and some meaning in this world by taking a job that makes them go city to city and house to house to take this census. And as he's taking the census, you start to get clues about what's happened because of people's reaction to this census. What does this census mean? What is he actually involved in? But again, the writing is just beautiful. It's this beautiful, poetic story. And I think stories about parents and special needs children always have kind of a special place in my heart. So I think maybe that's one reason that I really loved this. But I did really love it. So if you are looking for an adult, modern, well-written dystopia to dive into, Census would be a good one. And my third one, which this one is wildly popular, but fit into this category, and I do really love this book, is Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. Have either one of you read this?
No.
Okay. So this was her biggest book. It got a ton of play. I think you would both really like this one. I actually just DNF'd another Emily St. John Mandel. I've been wanting to read another one of her books, and then I DNF'd it over the summer. I didn't like it. The Glass Hotel, I did not like. But this is amazing.
If you're new to the podcast, for Trisha to not finish a book, that is
a big deal.
Huge.
It's becoming less of a big deal. I'm getting better at putting something
up. I appreciate your boundaries.
Yeah. But this one is a post-pandemic dystopia, which is interesting because it came out in like 2017 or 2018, I think. So it was before our actual pandemic. But this is a pandemic that like wiped out like 90% of the world. Mm. And so it is a world that has been decimated by massive loss of life. But it focuses on a Shakespeare troupe, a group of people. Yeah. A group of people that decide their way of coping with this is to create the old English tradition of a Shakespeare troupe. So it's a very literary. Close Reads has almost made the Close Reads list a couple of times. All the Close Reads people love it.
My word.
Yeah. So you're walking through a dystopian landscape with a Shakespeare troupe. And it's just a wonderful story. It's really masterful. And I highly recommend it.
Okay. That last one sounds like a real zinger. For some reason, my mind pictured like Walking Dead, but Shakespeare. So I don't know why. That's just wanted you to know that's where I was in your description. I was like, okay. Amanda, you went already or no?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
So if I've ever, sometimes mine and Amanda's, like our Myers-Briggs overlap, some of our things. I don't usually have a problem picking my books, but I went full Amanda today, y'all. I just, and there are so many, and it's not that I've read every one and I just wanted to bring them all, but I think each dystopian book I read really leads me with something, and it's a lingering idea. What if X was considered bad in our world, you know? And so it's hard for me to think which one of those I would be more okay with than not. So it's the idea more than the book that really lasts for me. So I'm just going to pick at random, I think, and I'll go with just something maybe that hasn't been talked about. I think I've said on here before that I read Atlas Shrugged merely because it was Charlie's favorite book. And I read it in the worst tiny paperback book. And you can't make a tiny paperback book of a giant book because it just, it's too thick. It was like 2x4 and 6 foot deep. You know, it was just, it was like, how do you open this book? You know, like the binding just needs to get broken or something.
Yeah.
So I read that and there was a lot of it that I thought, some of her way of telling the story was almost too obvious. And it just felt contrived. But the tone of what if we shut down our hardest working people? What if we shut down our brightest minds because it wasn't fair? Is something that I continue to come back to. And I loved some of the ways she illustrated it and some of the ways I thought, no, I'm not for that. I think you went too far. But the question she's asking, what if hard work was frowned upon? What if brilliance was legislated in favor of fairness? What would our world be? And you know, the way she slowly, and I say slowly because it's a long book, unravels this happening and then this happening and then, oh no, this happening until you get to this big train explosion that just came because we don't really have good parts and good ingenuity anymore. And our world is slowly crumbling. It was really lasting to me. And if you ever look up and you feel like you're the hardest person, working person in the room, and that's frustrating to you, I would just like to say thank you. Thank you for that, because maybe that's the thing that you can offer that others can't, and don't stop doing it. We're all benefiting from your genius or from your hard work or from your ideas or from your asking the annoying questions that no one else asks. That's great. Our world is good because of that. And I continually go back to, if we legislated that, we would be worse. And then another one that I really was left with. Amanda said Fahrenheit 451, so I won't go into it, but I think that one is like, ugh, for me. But 1984, when what you said about repulsion, Amanda, I spent every page of that book just repulsed.
Oh, yeah.
Repulsed. It was so gross and dirty, literally and just like emotionally. The idea that you can't trust your mind, the idea that you are gaslighted by every angle, every street sign, every day at your work into, I'm sorry you experienced this, it wasn't true. And look, we have a reprinted newspaper to prove it. And the way that our minds, no one can touch your mind is something that I believe. But on the other hand, what if you're continually from every angle told that is not true? And it really left me on, we really have to have truth, y'all. We really have to be able to say, okay, but this is real. This is true. This is this thing is concrete. Because if it's not, what is our society? So those were my Grip Me, Never Leave Me. And Hunger Games is written, and everyone's read that. It's written and written and written, and we've all read it. But I think it was one of the very commercialized ones that was really, really good. I liked the movies, which was pretty unexpected, I felt like, and they did that well. They told a broad cautionary tale on a level that everyone could understand. And they visited so many big things in it. It didn't leave me all the repulsion of 1984, but it was like your gateway drug into dystopian books. Okay, if you liked Hunger Games, would you like to read 1984? You know?
Yeah.
Because you have to start small sometimes, but
that book gave me a lot of images that have stayed with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really frustrated and disappointed with the ending.
Yeah.
And don't get Ben started on Hunger Games. If you want to hear a lecture and just have a seat,
I super want
ask
to
ask him about it. Yeah. I mean, it'd probably be I find them very entertaining when he gets going. But yeah, I mean, if that's like your marijuana, like your gateway drug into it, you know, that can be a good thing. And I have to share something that I learned listening to the Literary Life podcast, episode 92, about Fahrenheit 451. Highly recommend that. To go, we love the Literary Life here, and a lot of our listeners do too. But they talked about A defining characteristic of dystopian fiction is the tension and the relationship between dystopia and utopia. And Utopia was actually a book written in the 1500s by, was it St. Thomas More or Sir Thomas More? I don't remember. And the Greek word utopia means nowhere. So dystopia means bad where or bad place. Hmm. Utopia is no place. And this was his idea of a perfect society. And the Greeks, Virgil, Homer, etc., have written about finding the perfect state, but then losing it. And Dante also wrote about this. You can't, well, I'll get back to Dante in a minute. But Angelina in this episode talks about Genesis. Man is exiled from the garden where we had heaven on earth, or utopia. We lost it. We're exiled from home. We had the perfect existence. And ever since, we have this hole in our soul, which is a longing for home. And she makes the argument that all stories are ultimately about this longing for home and trying to satisfy that. It's the journey of the soul from Eden to New Jerusalem, and we can't fulfill that here. Dystopian fiction fits into that because it is the story of the Tower of Babel, where man tries to fill that longing with their power, with their pursuit of deity and being deity, and they're always thwarted. And Dante writes about trying to satisfy this longing too, which I'm almost finished with Inferno. I feel like I say that every episode. But you can't turn around and go back to Eden. And there's lots of stories where people try to get back to an Eden, but they're thwarted. So because of the fall, we're all exiles. So this longing for home becomes an odyssey. And so she's building the case because she thinks all stories are about that. And the odyssey, the journey of the hero, is, I think, maybe the preeminent framework of all literature. And you've already mentioned Odysseus. He finally gets back home to his faithful Penelope. And then listen to this. I read an article by Renee Mathis. Jane Eyre is also an odyssey. I'm getting back to dystopia, I promise. But her story is an odyssey to find home.
Yeah.
And you think about all the places where she lived, and there were problems with all of them, till finally at Ferndene, she at last finds safety and security and love. Wherever you are is my home, my only home. And this is the soul longing to be home with God. So dystopian novels, man tries to create this utopia on earth, but it becomes a hellscape, a dystopia, through all these different means. And that, I think that's what you're talking about too. They have different ways that they're trying to create heaven on earth. Maybe it's the drugs, the tyranny, the genetic manipulation. They imagine all these ways we might try to fill that longing, and they never work. So that's an inherent irony of this genre. Man-made utopia becomes dystopia because we cannot do it. This is like above our pay grade to fix the curse. God part on the world.
And I think that's fascinating because, Elizabeth, you mentioned that the people who sit on the other side of the aisle from you, they're not doing what they're doing because they're evil masterminds. They're doing what they're doing because they believe it's going to get us to somewhere good. And in most dystopian books, the society was constructed with good intentions. It was done for, quote, the good of the people. And it becomes tyranny, or it becomes oppression. And I think that's why it's so powerful, is because it's asking these questions, these things that we are doing today. So again, we've recorded two in a row, The Professor and the Madman. We talked a little bit about medication and medicating genius. We do that to alleviate suffering.
Mm-hmm.
We read about Dr. Minor and we say, this man suffered his whole life. And now we have medication we can give him that dampens those parts of his brain so that he does not suffer so much. And in a case like Dr. Minor's, I would say that's probably a good thing. So I'm not saying that that's never a good thing. I think in those extreme cases, it is a good thing that these people do not have to suffer like that their whole lives. But then you move into a book like Brave New World, what if, or even Fahrenheit 451, both of those worlds, everyone is medicated because it, quote, makes them happy. Mm-hmm. Why do we have to solve all of these problems when we can just medicate everyone into, quote, happiness?
Yeah.
So, and then the big question is, Where are we as a society on that journey? Where am I on that journey? Where is my family on that journey? And do I want to keep going down that road? And that's a big, important question. And I would not have the framework to ask that question without those dystopian works.
Right.
Yeah. And also piggybacking off on this concept that it doesn't always start with bad intentions.
Yeah, I think that's important.
In history, especially World War One, which was the beginning, like the 20th century was awful in terms of leaders just killing millions, millions of their people in different parts of the world. But World War One leaders at the end of the war thought that they could create heaven on earth, peace through politics, redrawing the map. We read about that and Everything Sad is Untrue.
Yeah.
In the Middle East, they drew those countries' boundaries regardless of the history of the peoples, the boundaries that were already there for thousands of years for the different ethnic groups, the cultures, etc. Or it's the rise of modern medicine to conquer diseases, better living through science. This was all happening around the same time, and this was when dystopian literature began in earnest as a genre.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
You've got the roots, going back into the 17th century. And perhaps the first dystopian short story, perhaps the first dystopian story was a short story by E.M. Forster called The Machine Stops. He wrote Horatio Hornblower. I didn't know he had dystopian fiction as well. I've got to read this. But then you get into H.G. Wells, Huxley, and 31 or 32, and Lewis, That Hideous Strength. I forgot to mention that one. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Orwell, then Bradbury, etc. So this all goes hand in hand. And in these genre episodes, we like to ask, is there something redeeming about this genre? Once you get through all the fluff, the more commercial parts of this, are there deeper meanings? Is this part of the great conversation? Well, I think the best of this genre is deeply Christian, whether the author intends it or not, because it is shouting the dangers of our towers of Babel and taking into our hands what is not ours to bear and control.
Well said. I cannot think of a better wrap up than what you just said, Amanda. So, listeners, we have a question for you. Head on over to the Facebook group. If you have not joined us on Facebook, just type in, go into your nice Facebook search bar and type Book Fair, BookFare, and you will find us. There is a group and a page. Like the page to see our announcements and join the group to join the conversation. And we are going to ask you, do you like dystopian literature? What are your favorites? What do you recommend? And what do you want to read after listening to this episode?
I wanted to end on this note. That dystopian stories, because they are fundamentally a Christian idea, they offer perspective. And the perspective of knowing humanity and one's own role and limitations are the key to humility, which leads to repentance, which leads to forgiveness, which leads to the true freedom and utopia. And the Christian has the language and tools to identify that longing for home in ourselves and can rest in knowing that it will be filled when we arrive at the new Zion, to quote The Matrix. And like Jane, we will be able to say, wherever you are is my home, my only home.
And until next time, I'm Trisha.
I'm Amanda.
I'm Elizabeth.
And happy dystopian reading. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this, subscribe to Book Fair Podcast.
Join our private Facebook group. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram, or email us at chat@bookfairpodcast.com.
And you can help us continue to grow. Share an episode with a friend, mention us on social media, and leave a review in your podcast app. We'll see you next Tuesday.